Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download our iPhone and Android app for program and schedule information and podcasts of past programs. I'm Joseph Fink, the President Emeritus of Dominican University of California and the past Chairman of the Board of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors. More importantly, I'm here this evening as the chair of this program. It's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's program featuring Leon Panetta. Leon Panetta is a man of the people and a man who has served his country beyond the call of duty. He began that service in 1974 when he became the congressman from the Monterey area, where he served for 16 years. He left that position in 1993 to become the director of the Office of Management and Budget in the Clinton administration, and then became the president's chief of staff. After leaving the Clinton administration in 1997, Secretary Panetta joined his wife Sylvia to establish and co-direct the Panetta Institute for Public Policy in Monterey. He was called back to public service again, leaving his area that he loved so much to live, and became the director of the CIA in the Obama administration, where he ran the operation that brought Osama bin Laden to justice, and went from that position to be the Secretary of Defense. Over the years, he served on numerous boards, commissions, and has a host of honorary degrees as well, including one from Dominican University that he received along with his wife. In conversation with him this evening is Dr. Gloria Duffy, the President and CEO of the Commonwealth Club. Dr. Duffy served as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense and Special Coordinator for Cooperative Threat Reduction during the first term of the Clinton administration, where she negotiated denuclearization and dismantlement of weapons of mass destruction in countries of the former Soviet Union. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Duffy and Secretary Panetta.
Secretary Panetta, welcome.
I can't tell you how great it is to be here at the Commonwealth Club, Gloria. This is, for me, this is part of my home, so it's nice to be home.
Thank you for all of your service. Dr. Fink enumerated some of the roles, but they go back even further. Army intelligence officer, congressional staffer, all the way up to your recent role as Secretary of Defense. Thank you for your service. Thank you for your leadership. Thank you for writing such an informative and enormously intelligent and wise book.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
In all of the roles that in which you've served, it strikes me that being an excellent manager was a key element of your success. You've talked, for instance, about being invited to become CIA director in part to restore that agency to its stability and good reputation after some of the difficulties it had had during the initial war on terrorism and so on. How important do you feel good management is to effective policymaking, and how have you been able to manage your way to successful outcomes throughout your career?
Well, it's absolutely essential. I mean, especially when you're dealing with the agencies and departments that I've had the honor to lead. I mean, my first responsibility was when I was director of the Office for Civil Rights, and I had a lot of very dedicated people who were committed to the goal that we were involved in promoting equal education, and obviously involved in desegregating the dual school system. And then OMB director, and then running a White House staff, and then CIA director, and then the Defense Department, which is 3 million people in what is the largest office building, that's not a high rise in the world. And it probably comes down to a couple words, which is that you've got to be willing to kick ass, frankly, to be able to run these departments. And the key for me was to, first get into the department and agency and understand what its mission and its operations and kind of what the responsibilities were. And then secondly, to be able to work with the people that were there. I never thought it made a lot of sense to kind of walk into an agency and just get rid of everybody. I thought that would be a terrible mistake because you lose a lot of experience. But the ability to kind of go in and be able to assess people, their capabilities, how they do their job, and what they do, and how dedicated they are. I thought that was important. And then thirdly, it's very important in any one of these jobs to set goals, to set objectives. You can't just walk in and move stuff from the inbox to the outbox. And unfortunately, I think the problems that we see today, whether it's with the Secret Service, or the IRS, or the Veterans Administration, or some of the problems that we see now just in dealing with Ebola. I think part of the problem is people get lazy. They start to do things by the numbers. They don't really get involved in recognizing that they have to be at the top of their game. And so strong supervision is really important. You've got to give people a goal, you've got to give them a mission, and you've got to give them the incentive to understand that they've got to accomplish that mission. And if they don't, you've got to be willing to hold them accountable, which means that when people screw up, you don't just ignore it. You've got to be able, you've got to fire people if they don't do their job. And make very clear to others that if they don't do their job, the same thing is going to happen to them. And I think too often we excuse incompetence. And as a result, everybody thinks that somehow, no matter how bad things are, that you can get away with it. So again, working with the people there, setting goals, being strong with people that do their jobs and being strong with people that don't do their jobs. And then lastly, making them feel like they're part of a team. It's really important that you bring people together to have an honest discussion about the challenges you're facing and how to deal with it. One of the things I did at every job I had, and frankly, it was not true at the CIA, it was not true at the Defense Department, was to establish a staff meeting where I brought the key people. And at defense, it was both the military leadership as well as the civilian leadership into a staff meeting. I did the same thing at CIA. Every day we had a top-level staff meeting. It was the first thing that happened in the morning. And by the way, I did this at the White House as well. And we went through, what are the issues we're dealing with? What's happening on the Hill? What are the challenges? Are we ready to deal with it? What's taking place? And really get a sense of what's going on. And I would, try to really share my views in an honest way with the people that were part of that team. And I expected them to do the same thing to me. One of the things I used to tell my staff is I never want to be surprised. Do not surprise me. If there's bad news, I want to hear it. You have to operate on that basis. And I said, if I have bad news, I'm going to tell you what the bad news is. But what that did was it helped develop an honest relationship with a team that really felt that they knew what was going on. And they then became part of an operation. So those are some of the guidelines. But in the end, it really is about staying on top of things and not just letting them slide, making sure you're accomplishing the goals that you set.
So you will be remembered for many things. Probably a key thing you'll be remembered for is being the guy who got Osama bin Laden. And you've made clear in your book, and otherwise it was a very large team effort and shared a lot of the the glory with others, but you, in fact, as head of the CIA, brought that mission to accomplishment. Do you feel that some of your approach going into the CIA, where you, in fact, didn't throw out all of the leadership and you sort of built on the team that was there, did it enable that mission to be successfully accomplished?
I think that was part of it. When I went to the CIA, obviously one of the top priorities in my mind was, where the hell is bin Laden and why have we not been able to find any indication as to where he was located? And the president made clear that that was a top priority as well, to go after bin Laden. And I remember bringing, you know, some of the people who had been working on that into my office at the CIA at Langley, and asking, you know, what's going on? And they were all kind of, beating their breasts and said, you know, we've been trying to find some evidence as to where he's at. Everything leads to a dead end. We really haven't had a good idea as to where he might be since Tora Bora, I think was the last time they thought they had a sense of where bin Laden was. And I said, look, I said, we have got to not just sit there and try to, you know, look at what might be coming in on bin Laden. You got to go out and seek it. You got to make sure we're doing things to try to find that out. And so what I did was I established a team of key people, and I said, I want to be briefed on this every week. I want to know what you're doing, and I don't want you to come into my room and just tell me that nothing's happening. I expect you to come into my room and tell me exactly what are you planning to do, what ideas are you looking at in order to try to go after it. So they did that, and there were several ways that they were trying to see if they could establish a lead to bin Laden. One was to follow one of his sons who was in captivity in Iran, actually in house arrest, and they released one of the sons, and we tried to do our best to see if we could follow him to into Pakistan. Unfortunately, he got into the wrong group of people in Pakistan. Became a target for one of our operations, and that took care of that son and that lead. The next thing was to use, obviously, some technology that is confidential, and trying to be able to determine if we could follow that to where bin Laden was, because we knew he was, using some computers and what have you, and hoped that we could find him that way. And that, that never really panned out. And then thirdly, it was the couriers. We knew he used couriers in order to be able to do his work. And he had a group of couriers that had been with him for a long time, but we could not identify them and who they were. And so what did happen is that they began to piece together intelligence pieces and eventually were able to identify the couriers and then put a face on the couriers. We located them in a town called Peshawar in Pakistan. We actually located the vehicle and the courier and followed them. Followed them from Peshawar to this place called Abbottabad. And it was at that point when we saw this compound at Abbottabad that, we got excited about what we were looking at. It was a compound that was about three times the size of other compounds in that area. It had 18-foot walls on one side, 12-foot walls on another side, barbed wire. They had an 8-foot wall on the third floor. Now, normally if you're on the third floor, you like to look at the view. So what the hell's an 8-foot wall doing on the third floor? So we knew this was high security, and somebody was in deep hiding. But we really didn't know. So we began again to piece together bits of information. One example is we were looking at the clothes on the clothesline and using that to determine how many family members were there. And it was the number of family members matched the number in bin Laden's family that we had determined he had. In addition to that, the big break was we were looking at a guy who, looked middle-aged, would go out into a yard in the compound and walk in circles like a prisoner in a prison yard. And he would do that almost every day.
So I said to my team, I said, for God's sakes, you got a guy out there in the yard. Let's try to identify him. Let's get a facial on the guy. Put a telescope on a mountain. Put cameras on the walls. I don't care what you do. They said, we just can't do it. There are walls in the way. We can't get a good shot. I said, I've seen movies where the CIA can do this. That's it. They said, no, we can't get it done. I said, well, at least tell me how tall the son of a bitch is. And so they said, well, maybe we can do that with the shadow. So they came back to me and said, yeah, he's somewhere between 5'7 and 6'5. I said, oh, that's all right. So, and it was at that point that we began to worry that, all of the work that was being done to track this might leak. And so that's when we were, went to the White House and reported all of this to the president. The president said, we better start planning operations. And so that's when we looked at the different operations to do it, which was it was an interesting. I went to Bill McCraven, who is head of Special Forces, and I said, what do we do if we have to do an operation here? And they looked at about three different approaches. One was just to have a B-2 bomber blow the hell out of the place. There was a certain attraction to that. And, but the problem was it would have taken so much firepower to do that that it would have leveled a few villages nearby. And that we decided not to do that. And then we looked at using a drone. But the problem with that was first of all, little tricky as to whether or not, you in fact could hit that target. But secondly, if you did it, we would never know if it was bin Laden. So that's when we decided on the commando raid. And the commando raid was really, by the way, when we did the, we looked at the commando raid, there were two options. One is to work with the Pakistanis, and one was to not to work with them. The problem is, with the Pakistanis, we would sometimes tell them where there were targets, because they always used to bitch that we were doing things and never telling them anything. So I said, look, we'll tell you what, we gave them some targets. And then what we would find out is they would tell the targets that something was up and they'd take off. So he said, we can't work with these guys. We can't trust them. So we decided to do this on our own, which meant that you had to send a team, of about 24 SEALs into Pakistan at night, 150 miles. Two helicopters going in, rappelling down, and going into the compound. So it was a very risky operation. And as I said in the book, when we went to the National Security Council, I have to tell you, most of the people in the National Security Council thought it was too risky. And I told the president that, I thought it was worth doing. I said, Mr. President, I use an old formula when I face a tough decision, and I did this in Congress, which is when you face a tough decision, pretend you're asking an ordinary citizen in your district, what would you do if you knew what I knew? And I said, if an average citizen knew that we had the best information on the location of bin Laden since Tora Bora, I think most would say we really have to conduct this operation. And secondly, we had tremendous confidence in the SEALs to conduct it. So they did. They went in. They accomplished the mission. A tremendous amount of credit goes to all of those that were involved. But, I think they sent a very clear message to the world that nobody attacks the United States and gets away with it.
I understand that when you took the job at the CIA, you were told that you were going to become the combatant commander, which was a bit of a new role for a CIA director, sort of a shift towards active management of military operations. Were you surprised by that?
Yeah, frankly, I was, because I thought when I took the job, I'd be, at least my experience with a CIA director was to gather intelligence and analyze that intelligence and then present that to the president and other policymakers, that was the primary role. So, when I was involved with intelligence, certainly in the Army, but as chief of staff to the president, and we got intelligence briefings, most of that was based on, obviously, information that's presented to the president and what's called the PDB. So I thought, you know, that that was largely going to be the role, and it was an important role, considering that we were at war with terrorism. And then when I went to see Mike Hayden, who was my predecessor there, Hayden said to me, look, after we went through a number of things, he said, let me tell you something. You're going to be a combatant commander in the war on terrorism. I said, you know, what are you talking about? And then he described the operations that the CIA was involved with. And these were very aggressive operations to go after the leadership of Al-Qaeda in the tribal areas in Pakistan. And it was largely a CIA operation because the Pakistanis obviously did not allow the military, our military, to go in. They didn't allow F-16 fighters to go in and blow the leadership up. They didn't allow special forces to go in with boots on the ground. So it became a clandestine operation to go after the leadership of Al-Qaeda, and the CIA largely developed those operations, and I have to tell you that they were extremely effective. These are counterterrorism operations. They involve, by the way, developing sources on the ground to identify targets. It took us 3 years to develop those sources on the ground, spies, to be able to determine where, you know, the key leadership for Al-Qaeda was located. We then were able to, using those sources, be able to go in and do surveillance, target them. I know, you know, there's obviously this debate about the use of drones, but I have to tell you that a drone is a very precise and effective weapon in that instance. I did not, as CIA director, did not take a shot if there was family members that were nearby. You always wanted to isolate the target, and we were effective at doing that. The end result, and by the way, those operations are not just the CIA director's operations. The President of the United States authorizes those operations. The President of the United States was aware of every operation we were involved in. And he should be. He's the commander-in-chief. You know, these are his operations. And so the president was involved in those operations. The Congress was involved in those operations. Every one we did, I briefed the Congress on. Every operation that we did, I briefed the Congress, the intelligence committees, about those operations. And every one of the targets was developed with the Justice Department, so that nobody was on a target list unless the Justice Department confirmed that they were an enemy, a combatant who was dangerous to the United States. So there is a process that really does try to ensure that we abide by the right standards under our system to make sure that it works. And the end result, I have to tell you, is that we were largely successful at undermining their leadership, and in doing that, helping to prevent people who would otherwise want to organize another attack on the United States. We were able to weaken that leadership, and I think ultimately prevent them from conducting another attack on this country.
There are so many examples we could talk about where you brought people together, managed them well, provided leadership, and got an extraordinary outcome. Another one was the budget compromise and the tax cut during the Clinton administration, which in your book you contrast with the sequestration and the stalemate that occurred years later in the Obama administration. Can you talk a little bit about the budget compromise and the difficult-to-swallow tax cut that you helped bring about during the Clinton administration?
Well, you know, by the way, I've seen Washington at its best, and I've seen Washington at its worst. I mean, I've seen Washington work, and I think people need to remember that Washington can work. When I first went back, some friends here that worked with me, with Tom Kuchel when he was senator, and went back as a legislative assistant to Tom Kuchel,
At the time, there were other senators like Kuchel representing that kind of progressive republicanism. People like Javits and Clifford Case and Hugh Scott Mark Hatfield and others, George Aiken, who were working with people like Henry Jackson, Hubert Humphrey, Bill Fulbright, Symington, Dick Russell. And they had their political differences. Of course they had their political differences. They fought each other in elections. But when it came to major issues facing the country, Lyndon Johnson and the leadership of the Congress worked together to try to develop answers. I mean, and landmark legislation resulted in civil rights, in education, on the environment, in a number of areas as a result of the work that was done. When I got elected, Tip O'Neill and Bob Michael, Tip O'Neill was the speaker, Bob Michael was the minority leader, they had their political differences, but they were committed to working together to try to deal with the challenges we faced. On the budget summits, I mean, I was a member of every budget summit going back to the Reagan administration, first one. And what the leadership did, along with the president sent his representatives to the Hill, and then the leadership, Republican and Democrat, selected the members that would go into a room, and they said, you're going in that room, you're going to put everything on the table, and you're not going to come out of that room till you cut a deal. I mean, that was the direction. We are not going to fail. It's too important to the country for you to fail. And it was tough. These are tough negotiations, dealing with, you know, entitlements, dealing with discretionary spending, defense spending, and revenues. But every major summit deal was made on the basis of combining those elements and really producing a major deficit reduction plan. I mean, the Bush administration, God, we were out at Andrews Air Force Base for 3 months. 3 months working on a deal. Not easy. I mean, you're not dealing with some pleasant people in some of these meetings. and Newt Gingrich was sitting there with his feet up on the table reading the paper. John Sununu was pretending like he was interested. And I mean, I remember Bobby Byrd just tearing his hide off because he wasn't paying attention. But we did it. We did it. We came up with a plan, and we passed it. And in the Clinton administration, you know, the Republicans took a walk. They didn't want to participate in it. So the Democrats had to put it together with the president. And we again put every one of those elements into the budget. We did entitlement savings. We went after savings in Medicare, in Medicaid, on farm programs. We went after savings in defense. We put a cap on discretionary spending, both domestic and defense. And we raised revenues. $500 billion over 5 years, pretty much equally divided. $250 billion in spending cuts, $250 billion in tax increases. And it was tough. It's tough. You know, it was tough on the Democratic side. And by the way, governing is tough. Governing's tough. I mean, you've got to go after it. You want to pass something in the Congress? This isn't a pretty please process. And it's not about logic. Not about logic. I mean, you know, you could describe and present logic, but then you got to kick ass. You got to go in and get the votes and make sure it happens. I mean, you know, Abraham Lincoln in the Lincoln movie, it was a good description of wanting to pass the 13th Amendment, and Lincoln made very clear, we are going to pass the 13th Amendment, and we'll buy the votes we need in order to get it if we have to. Well, hell, when we had to pass the budget, I think I must have sold 6 bridges to be able to go after the votes that I needed to get it done. And it was tough. It was tough. I mean, we had to pass it with Democratic votes. It was very tight. Many members did not want to support the tax increases. And so we were there at the vote, and we counted every vote. We had a war room going after every vote. We knew where everybody was supposed to be. And suddenly, Congresswoman Mazvinsky
from Pennsylvania. She votes no. And I said, what the hell's happening? She was supposed to be a yes. And so I called Tom Foley, who was the speaker at the time, and Dick Ephart, and I said, for God's sakes, you've got to go after her. She's, you know, she voted the wrong way. So I could see it on television that, you know, these huge bodies, Tom Foley was like a bear, and he's walking down, and all these suits are walking down to the well, and Ms. Vinsky was there. Basic mistake. You vote against the leadership, get the hell off the floor of the House. She didn't do that. So they all just crowded around her, tried to convince her to change her vote, and then she said something like, I'll change if the President of the United States comes into my district and explains to people what this budget's all about. So they called me and said, will the President come into her district? I didn't even call the President. I said, absolutely. Absolutely. Whatever the hell it takes. And so she changed her vote, and we won it by one vote on the House floor. But on the Senate side, it was the same thing. It was the day of the vote, and we were, you know, going through all of our vote counts. And Bob Kerry was going to be a yes vote, and we couldn't find him. We didn't know where the hell he was. So I asked the Secret Service, will you go find this guy, wherever the hell he's at? And what we found out is he went to a movie. The movie on the day of the vote, for God's sakes. So I said, find him. And they did. They found him in a movie theater. It was not a dirty movie. It was just, you know, he was just watching a movie, for God's sakes. So he dragged his rear end up to the hill. And he voted yes. The vote was 50-50. 50-50. And the vice president cast the deciding vote. The message is, you know, that I just want to convey to you is that if you want to get things done in Washington, you got to roll up your sleeves and fight for it. I mean, let me just tell one other story that's in the book. It's a wonderful story. There was a congresswoman from Detroit. This is the crime bill, I believe. And she was listed as voting no. Again, we were going through our vote counts. So I went up to her and I said, what the hell is going on? I said, you're supposed to support the president. This is an important vote. Crime bill includes all of these, you know, key provisions. I mean, you ought to be for it. She said, I just got some problems with this, Leon. I don't know, you know, I don't think I can do this. So I went back to the White House, and the next day I got a call from her. And she said, please come up. I want to talk to you. So I went up and I said, what can I do? She said, Leon, last night I had a dream. I said, okay. What was your dream? She said, I dreamt that Jesus talked to me. I said, what did Jesus have to say? By the way, this is the honest to God truth. I mean, I can't make this stuff up. So I said, what did Jesus have to say? She said, Jesus said to me that I really should support the President of the United States if I get the casino I want in downtown Detroit. It's really, really interesting what Jesus is into these days. So I called Bruce Babbitt, who was the Secretary of Interior. I said, you know, get down there, talk to her. Let her know that, you know, we're going to consider getting the casino there. He said, I hate the idea. I said, I don't give a damn what you hate. You're going to go down there and tell her that we're going to consider the casino. So he goes down there and talks to her. We get her vote, pass the crime bill, and she got her casino. So, but that is part of the process. You know, it involves rolling up your sleeves and fighting for every vote. But the end result is right. You get it done. And you know, for Clinton, he did it on the budget. He did it on NAFTA. He did it on the crime bill. He did it on, you know, other proposals in education. And that's the nature of it. That's the nature of the process. And somehow, you know, that ability to get in and work at it, you know, just doesn't seem to be, you know, what's driving the nature of Congress right now in terms of dealing with major issues.
Let me just say for our radio and internet audience, this is the Commonwealth Club of California, and we're speaking with Secretary Leon Panetta this evening. So we'll come back to this question of what's changed, the objectives and the ability to compromise and really make policy. Let's roll it back a little ways. You had a wonderful, interesting childhood here in Northern California. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your childhood in Carmel and your family background, and just as part of understanding how you learn to be someone who brings people together and is able to make pragmatic compromise.
Well, you know, I guess what I wanted to describe for readers is the American story. And I've had the privilege of living that story. I mean, I'm the son of Italian immigrants who came to this country like millions of others in the early 30s. Very little money, few skills, no language ability. Picked up and left the comfort of their home in order to come to this country. And my father was the 13th in his family, and he had several brothers who'd come over before. And he had one brother, his oldest brother, Bruno, settled in Sheridan, Wyoming, and I think was working on the railroads and then working in some of the mines up there. And Tony was another brother who came to California. And so when they arrived, the tradition is you visit your older brother first. So they went to visit Bruno in Sheridan, Wyoming. And they spent one winter in Sheridan, Wyoming. And my mother said, I think it's time to visit your other brother in California. So they made it to California, and thank God to Monterey, where I was born. And my father started a restaurant during the war years in Monterey. And, some of you will remember, Monterey during the war years was a jumping town. They had, they were catching sardines left and right, and Cannery Row, Steinbeck's Cannery Row, was in full operation during those days. And Fort Ord was there. Fort Ord was a major training post where young men were coming there to be trained for the battlefields of both the Pacific and Europe. And so downtown Monterey was a jumping place because these guys, this was their last stop for civilization. And my dad was, cooking in the restaurant. My mother handled the register. She had a button under the register to call the MPs if anybody got out of line. And that happened quite a bit. Part of an Italian family is that, they believe in working hard, and they had traveled here, and they'd come to this country, a lot of opportunity, but they also knew that they had to work hard, and they taught us to work hard. My earliest recollections were, standing on a chair in the back of that restaurant washing glasses because my family believed that child labor was a requirement for all of us. And then my dad, after the war, sold the restaurant, and bought some land in Carmel Valley, and he may not have had a hell of a lot of education, but he had street smarts about where he should invest his money. So he bought the land in Carmel Valley and planted a walnut orchard. And again, my brother and I worked alongside my father, the hose, irrigation pipes, doing all the work you do on a farm. And as the trees got older, my dad would go around with a pole and hook and shake each of the branches. And my brother and I used to be underneath collecting the walnuts. When I got elected to Congress, my father said, you've been well-trained to go to Washington because you've been dodging nuts all your life. but they deeply believed in this country, and they encouraged us to give back to the country because what the country had given them. And I think I always remember, you know, both my father and mother really being very supportive of, you know, us getting involved, doing things for the community. I was inspired to public service in large measure by my parents because of their encouragement. I was inspired to public service for 2 years in the Army because I really saw people come together from every part of the country on a common mission work together for that. And I was encouraged by a young president who said, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And public service was a higher calling, and I really felt that. And that's why when I got out of the Army, you know, I really looked for a chance to be able to go back to Washington and work.
I was interested in your story about your nonno, your grandfather, who came to visit and got essentially stuck in the U.S. at the outbreak of World War II. And our mutual friend Norm Mineta, who was interned during World War II, has said that it's that experience that caused him to want to go into public life, to make sure that by being a player and having a role and influence, people from his ethnic background could never have that happen again. And I was interested in the story of your grandfather, who was sent away from Carmel because he was from a country with which the U.S. was at war, and he was sent up to San Jose to live and couldn't live with your family. Just wondering if there's any.
It's one of those things you remember as a boy because my parents were working in the restaurant. And my grandfather came over to visit my mother and got stuck here because the war broke out, and they wouldn't let him go back. It was soon after 1938. And then, as a result of being an alien from Italy, they did not allow him to return. So, but which was a good thing for me because he basically sat with me and he used to walk me down to the wharf. He used to take care of me. Frankly, I had to learn to speak Italian because that's all he spoke. If I didn't speak Italian, I wasn't going to get dinner. So I learned how to speak Italian as a result of having him. He was a wonderful guy. He was a very, very warm individual. What I did was, he became really in many ways, the person that that I was very close to. And what happened was that at one point they decided that they would move Italians inland from the coast. And so he was ordered to move inland. And so we had to find a place in San Jose for him to be able to stay at a boarding house. And I can remember, driving up with my parents and my nonno and bringing him there. And as a young boy, trying to figure out what was going on, why was this happening? We did that, and I think he stayed there for almost a year before he was able to come back. And so, Norm Mineta, who was a good friend, Norm and I used to talk a lot about the impact of that in terms of certainly it doesn't compare to what happened to Japanese Americans in internship, but internment, rather. But yet, it was a common experience that in many ways it impacts on you because you're not sure what it means, why it's happening. But at the same time, you kind of understand that, we were a country at war, and it brought the war right to your family. By the way, Norm Mineta is a dear friend, and Tip O'Neill, who I talked about, used to always confuse us. He used to call me Norm and Mineta Leon. And, Mineta's Japanese-American. And then the Carter administration came in, and they screwed it up as well. When the Italian prime minister came, they would call Norm Mineta to come to the White House for the dinner. And when the Japanese prime minister came, they would call me to go down to the White House. And so finally, Norm and I put a team together, a softball team, and we said we're going to play under the sign of the rising pizza. And we did.
It seems like another great influence for you was working as a young staffer for Thomas Kuchel, who was a moderate Republican who could reach across the aisle, who could make a deal. And it seemed like you cast yourself in that mold, and that has been a continuity through your life.
Yeah, no, I think I learned an awful lot from that experience. And it was a great experience. In the book, I tell the story about, when I first got back there. But, interesting story how I got to Washington. I didn't know anybody in Washington. I never had any contacts in Washington. And I was getting out of the Army, and my father wanted me to practice law in Monterey, and I just wanted to do something more. I really did want to go back to Washington and do something there, but I didn't know who to turn to. So I wrote a presidential aide to Lyndon Johnson by the name of Joe Califano. Now, I didn't know Califano, but I figured maybe an Italian might help another Italian. So I wrote him and said, I'm really very proud to see that, you're serving in that position as an Italian-American. I'm very interested to try to do the same thing. And I'll be damned if Joe Califano didn't call me up. I was in the intelligence, the G2 shop at Fort Ord. I was, in uniform. He calls me up, get this call from a presidential aide. And he sets up some meetings in Washington. I go back, and I get interviewed at several of the departments, and then I go up to Capitol Hill and walk into Tom Kuchel's office, just because I liked him as a senator. And sure enough, they had an opening for a legislative assistant. And I talked to, his wonderful guy named Hewing Haas, who was his administrative assistant. And Ewing interviewed me and then set me up with a meeting with the senator, and the senator hired me, I think largely because I just came out of the Army and I was a lawyer. He was good enough to hire me. And then when I went back to Washington, he brought his legislative assistant into the office. He was the minority whip under Everett Dirksen. And I'll never forget this. I mean, there were just two of us that were working in his personal office. And one guy was handling defense and foreign policy issues, and the other, me, was handling domestic issues. I mean, today, if you go into a Senate office, there's something like 25 assistants that are dealing with the senator. In those days, there were just two of us. And the senator said, and I never forgot this, he said, look, you're going to be tempted in this town. There are going to be a lot of people that will want to take you to lunch, that want to give you things in order to influence my vote. And I just want you to remember that we're here to serve the interests of the people of California and of the country. And I also want you to remember one thing. When you get up in the morning, you have to look at yourself in the mirror. And I never forgot that. Because that basically was, you have to protect your integrity and you have to do what's right. And he, he was somebody who did that. He, a moderate Republican, supported civil rights legislation, supported labor legislation, did some wonderful things on park legislation, developed the Redwood Park, worked with Henry Jackson, worked with Democrats to basically, be able to get things done. And I learned from that experience because, the one thing I remember is on the civil rights bills, we set up a team to work on the civil rights bills that were made up of both Republicans and Democrats. And so we had a team. I think Clifford Case was on it. Jacob Javits was on it. Bobby Kennedy had a representative on that team. We had representatives from Phil Hart and his group. So we had a whole team that was set up to, as I said, go after the votes on the Civil Rights Bill. And by the way, that was a time when Everett Dirksen basically made the decision that the right thing to do for the country. He said the time has come to do the right thing on civil rights. I mean, this is a Republican minority leader who took a very strong stand, and that helped us ultimately pass some of the key civil rights bills at the time. So I learned from that process of kind of give and take and, you know, working with people and trying to develop the compromises that would allow you to move something forward. You never got everything you wanted. But in the process of give and take, what you did was you moved the ball forward. You got something done. And even though it wasn't everything that you wanted, it was moving the country in a better direction. And that is the process. That goes back to our forefathers and the process that they thought was important for this country, which is, you know, in a system of checks and balances, and it's a very effective system of checks and balances, it can be a formula for gridlock, as we see today. But their hope was that people working together, talking about issues, yes, they would have different beliefs, yes, they had different ideologies, but in the end, they would work together to find consensus. And frankly, that's what they did on the Constitution. Constitution is a work of consensus building. You know, one of the finest documents representing consensus. And I think that's what it's about. That's what it's about. When you are elected to office, the responsibility is to serve the people, to get things done. It isn't about pounding your shoe on the table. It isn't about just protecting ideology. It certainly isn't about shutting the government down and hurting people. It's about doing what you can to make this country better. That's what it's all about.
There are a number of questions from the audience about current events, as you might expect, and a lot of them are about ISIS. So I'm going to combine a couple of these. Where did ISIS come from? Where did they train? What's our most effective role in Iraq and Syria? And then looking backwards, what should the U.S. have done to have prevented ISIS from sprouting?
Yeah. How much time do we have? let me try to keep this as tight as I can. ISIS represents, obviously, a very dangerous, fanatical, evil, terrorist organization that is well-funded, well-armed, well-trained to engage in the kind of warfare that they're involved with there. They developed in the chaos of Syria, which was totally chaotic in the civil war that had developed there. There were a number of opposition groups that were involved in Syria, almost 100 different groups in the opposition, many of them not working with each other, drawing from all kinds of, extremist groups. I mean, there was one group that we were aware of at the time that I was there called al-Nusra, which was basically an al-Qaeda group that had developed in Syria and drawn fighters to that cause. Frankly, very effective fighting force in Syria and was actually doing some very effective combat against the Assad Syrian army. And other groups as well, extreme groups were developing. ISIS, I believe, formed, in that chaos in Syria. And it was fed by some of the disruption that was going on in Iraq. When Prime Minister Maliki, really, in a very irresponsible way, decided that he was going to go after the Sunnis. It was after we withdrew our forces. Maliki then went after the Sunnis. kicked him out of the military, kicked him out of the government, fed into the old tribal conflict between Sunnis and Shias and Kurds. And in all of that disruption, a lot of the Sunnis who were disenchanted by what happened, many of them went across the border and became part of what developed as ISIS. So there are a lot of these disenchanted Sunni fighters who became part of ISIS, and they in turn attracted others, and that's how ISIS ultimately became together. Now, could it have been prevented? That's something that I think everyone kind of struggles with as you think about it. I do believe that it would have been better for us to have been able to maintain 8,000 to 10,000 troops in Iraq, along with our intelligence operations, along with a very strong diplomatic representation. We had developed a plan to do that, that the president supported. And we presented that to Maliki. I went there several times to urge him to accept that plan. And Maliki constantly, rejected it and said, well, no, he didn't really reject it. He said, yeah, we should do that. But then behind the scenes, he was basically working to make sure that it would not happen. He said the parliament would have to approve it. He kept bobbing and weaving and not really, doing it. And I've said that Maliki is largely to blame for that not happening. Maliki is certainly to blame for the disruption that took place afterwards and what fed into ISIS. Could we have done more to try to convince Maliki to do that? I think we probably could have pushed him harder. Maliki was the kind of individual that you had to sit on him, you had to kick him, you had to push him, you had to tell him what to do. I mean, everybody learned that, the only way you deal with Maliki is to really sit on him and force him to do what he has to do. But I think there was a sense that if they don't want to do this, why should we want it more than them? And I think, unfortunately, then, we pulled everybody out, and Maliki really fed into that. I think the Arab countries are partly responsible because they didn't like Maliki. They thought he was a shill for Iran. If you went to Saudi Arabia, if you went to other countries, they thought Maliki was in the pocket of Iran. And so they didn't provide the support they should have for the Iranian government. All of that, I think, combined with the chaos, as I said, in Syria, all of that is what produced ISIS. Having said that, ISIS, I believe, represents a real threat, not only to that region, but to our national security as well, because these are individuals who are so fanatical that if they're allowed to establish a caliphate state in that area, I think they would ultimately use it as a base of operations from which to attack our country. So I think the president made the right decision to go to war against ISIS. This is going to be a long and difficult war. There'll be ups and downs as we try to adjust our strategies to effectively deal with that threat. But I think it is the right thing to do, that we do everything possible to make sure that we disrupt and ultimately defeat ISIS so that we can protect our country.
Switching to a number of other comments on a topic related to climate change and the environment. Someone in the audience attended a big conference taking place in San Francisco today called Dreamforce and heard Vice President Gore speak there. Some now in Washington are saying that climate change is a threat to national security. What are your thoughts? And also in regard to the health of the oceans and the health of all of this, might this be a worthy fight, as in your book?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, there's no question. When I was at the CIA, we developed a whole section at the CIA to look at the impact of global warming, because very frankly, the impact of all of that does affect our national security. When there are serious droughts, when food is in short supply,
when there is an increase in the level of the sea levels impacting in various areas around the world. All of that affects our national security, and it's something we have to track. And I think the Defense Department, I had the same view that the Defense Department, that it was something we had to pay attention to, because ultimately, as a result of global warming, as a result of climate change, we are seeing the kind of changes take place in countries throughout the world that can really raise national security issues that we have to be aware of. Having said that, let me just get on the soapbox for a moment. I think the largest national security threat right now is the dysfunction in Washington. It is the dysfunction in Washington. Because, whether it's national security, whether it's climate change, whether it's dealing with the other issues that face this country, the problem you have is that there's a certain sense that, because, and look, I know this is a tough time, and I know, the percentage of nuts that are getting elected that are, the Tea Party types who basically want to, tear down government and disrupt it in every way, that's growing. But at the same time, I think there are members there that want to do the right thing. And but somehow, because of the barriers that are there, the political barriers, there's a sense that both sides, including the president and the leadership, have kind of given up. And so they've given up on dealing with, trying to develop a budget deal to try to, put us on the right track in terms of dealing with the future and trying to ultimately, again, reduce that debt and be able to apply the resources we need that we have to have for the future. So they've given up on that kind of budget deal. They've given up on immigration reform. They've given up on infrastructure funding. And all of the needs of our infrastructure. They've given up on developing the kind of energy, alternatives and programs, and also in that light, providing the kind of approach we need in energy areas to protect our environment and our climate at the same time. They've largely given up on that. They've given up on trade, developing the kind of trade legislation that could be very helpful, not only to the world economy, but to our economy. And so there's a sense that, things are so bad that we're just not going to be able to get things done. That's the attitude. They came back, for this last session, and all they did was they passed a CR and got the hell out of town to go back and run for re-election.
That's a continuing resolution. Just keeps the government going
Keeps the government funded in a short period of time. It's still, after the election. They'll come back in the holiday after the election, and the likelihood is that that they'll probably agree to just pass another CR, another continuing resolution, into the spring, and they won't confront any of these issues that the country needs to face. And we cannot have another 2.5 years of stalemate in this country. We can't. It's going to weaken our national defense. It's going to weaken our economy. It's going to weaken this country. And so, I don't know how to kickstart this stuff, but somebody's got to kickstart it. Somebody's got to roll up their sleeves and say, we have got to start doing the right thing. I use this example in the book because it was so disturbing for me, which was the sequestration thing that they came up with, which was a crazy, crazy idea to simply slash everything across the board. It was like that scene from Blazing Saddles where the sheriff puts the gun to his head and says, if you don't do the right thing, I'm going to blow my head off. Well, they said, if we don't do the right thing, if we don't get a budget deal, we will enact sequester, which will slash everything by $500 billion across the board. $500 billion in defense and another $500 billion cutting domestic programs over 10 years. It was devastating, and it has been devastating. So they didn't do the right thing. They didn't come up with a deal. So sequester goes into effect. And I remember going to the president and the leadership and saying, this is terrible.
I mean, you understand if sequester goes into effect, from the Defense Department's point of view, we're not going to do maintenance that we have to do. We're not going to deploy ships that have to be deployed. We're not going to be able to have air squadrons do what they have to do. They'll be grounded. We've got 800,000 people that'll be furloughed. I said it's going to hollow out our military. And on the domestic side, it's going to impact on those programs serving the most vulnerable in our society. Devastating cuts. And you know what? They all agreed with me. They said, you're right, it's terrible. It's terrible. So I said, okay, what do we do? What do we do? And they said, well, you know, it's tough politically to try to get anything done on this. I said, I'll put another $100 billion in defense savings on the table, if that'll help you cut a deal. And, you know, we need to get this done. Nothing happened. Nothing happened. They didn't even meet in a room to try to come up with a way to resolve this. And I used that old Teddy Roosevelt quote because it's appropriate here, which is, when you face a tough decision, the best thing you can do is to make the right decision. The next best thing you can do is to make the wrong decision. The worst thing you can do is to do nothing. And they did nothing. And it's something that for me is in many ways incomprehensible, because I think it's a violation of their oath of office not to do what's necessary in order to protect this country.
So this brings to mind your observation about Thomas Kuchel, that he taught you that integrity is more important than survival for a political figure, for a public servant. We're almost to the end of our time. I'd like to ask you what you are doing. Right now you're on a book tour and you're doing that. But when you get back home to Carmel and in the life that you're going about now, what are the things that you're doing to address this problem? I know you're working with young people, so tell us a little bit about what your life is like now back home in Carmel.
Yeah. No, it's, it's nice to be back home, and nice to be back in Carmel Valley and to be with my wife and sons and grandchildren and my dog, Bravo. By the way, I talk about Bravo in the book. Every once in a while, I bring Bravo back when I was at the CIA. And as a matter of fact, Bravo is in the portrait that is hanging at the CIA of me now. And
Bravo must be getting on in years.
Yeah, Bravo's 12 years old. But he sat in on all the briefings on the Bin Laden operation. And he never leaked a word. So it's nice to be home with Bravo. And we have my wife and I started this, Panetta Institute for Public Policy. And the reason we started is when I came back from being chief of staff to Clinton, that I was worried about young people's attitudes towards public service. That in many ways they were turned off. Now they didn't enjoy that inspiration to really get involved because of everything they were seeing. And so the goal of our institute is to try to inspire young people to get involved in public service. And so, we have a number of programs to try to do that, because I really believe that, we have to inspire them because they are an investment in the future. They're the ones that are going to be the leaders of our country. And look, let me tell you something. I would like this thing to change, what I just described. I'd like it to change from the top down. That's the way it should change. But if it doesn't change from the top down, it will change from the bottom up. Because good people will get elected who ultimately will, in fact, embrace the responsibility to govern this country. And so we've got to ensure that those young people are willing to do that. And let me tell you something. You know what makes me hopeful? I know it can be discouraging. But what makes me hopeful is that I have seen men and women in uniform who are willing to put their lives on the line to fight and die for this country. I mean, these are kids. You know, and I've seen him. I've seen him in Afghanistan. I've seen him in Iraq. I've seen him on the battlefield. They are willing to fight and die for this country. And surely if they're willing to do that, then our leadership ought to be willing to take a little bit of that risk in order to govern this country. That's what we need to inspire. So I'm going to continue to work at the Panetta Institute and try to get people that are going to be willing to engage, and also continue to speak both here and abroad on my views. And the purpose of the book, very frankly, somebody asked me, what'd you intend with the book? I said, I hope this book does, is it shakes Washington up because they need it.
Our thanks to you, Secretary Panetta, for being with us here at the Commonwealth Club, and more than that, for your long career of extraordinary service to this country.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
This meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the nation's largest and oldest public forum, is adjourned.